CliffCentral.com. Good morning, people of Earth. How are you? That's what Yoko Ono used to say, right?
People of Earth, how are you?
What a nutcase. All right, good morning. Let's get cracking. We've got a busy day today. We've got lots of things happening. I've got Mbulelo here. I've got Lebang here. And you got me for your sins. You've obviously been a very bad person in your previous life. Otherwise, things would have turned out better for you. What can I say? All right, let's get going. We've got... wow, let me tell you what's up on the show this morning. It's going to be busy. It's going to be fun. So yesterday, just by the way, we had this dude on for Collectomania who collects little Statue of Liberty. Well, not even little ones. All kinds of statues of Liberty. Do you see that?
I saw that. I was just like, this is an interesting collection.
It's when you think like, I thought the guy with the plastic apes the week before was pretty, you know, niched. But this guy is like Statue of Liberty plastic versions. Even better.
Yeah.
You know what
I mean?
There's
a lot of interesting things that people collect out there. Like week after week, I'm just like, wow, really?
Yeah.
Where do you get the time?
I know.
But it's a real thing, so kudos.
I know. We got JJ Cornish joining us this morning with a little bit of the African analysis, which we do every couple of weeks with the Johannesburg Business School. And if you haven't seen or heard that yet, you've been missing out. We're going to talk about Nigeria today and just what exactly is going on in that amazing country. And we will speak to a human lie detector. Yep. Her name is Lizette Falkveen, and she is able to tell if you're lying straight away. And she will tell you how. She will explain some of the tricks that you can use to figure out whether people you love, people you care about, people you work with, people you're suspicious of, whether or not they're lying to you. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Bulele, you're fucked.
Sure.
Sure.
How do you do?
Yes. It's going to be great.
Now people are going to know that I'm actually I'm a cross-dresser and all of that, you know?
Yeah, that's,
man.
That's the stuff you've been hiding for the longest time, right?
That's true.
So what's happening there, Bung? Give us an update, because apparently aren't you lining up some major dental surgery or something?
Sure, guys. Like, yesterday was a day from hell. So I've been literally at the dentist every Monday for the past, like, 2 weeks.
Oh, my God.
So the first time I went, you know, she's like, look, it's chaos in there. Hmm. We're going to have to do a root canal. So I'm like, you know what? I don't need this mess right now. Peace. And then I think it was yesterday, Sunday, I was just unable. I couldn't eat. I couldn't talk. So I went again yesterday. I'm like, hi, it's me again. I'm back. And she's like, look, we just have to do it. So I'm on, like, all these hectic antibiotics. And I've got, like, pus coming out of the bottom part of my mouth. It's
Jesus.
Really disgusting.
No, you didn't have to say that. No,
yeah.
You just spoiled my whole morning.
Look, I can even, like, I can even show you. So, like, if you look... it's horrible.
Oh, my God.
It's horrible.
Oh,
but I'm feeling a bit better today because, like, the pain meds have been just doing God's work. But at some point yesterday, I was just, like, rolling on the bed, like, up and down because I just couldn't deal with the pain. It was nonsense. So... just like side notes, if you ever have dental matters, just get them over and done with. It's not something you can just like, you know, keep pushing to the side. No, it really is not that kind
Listen,
of party. You have to get it done.
People don't know.
Yeah.
Until we had dentists, and I mean the kind that we have today, not those quacks that we had 150 years ago who used to like attach your tooth to a piece of string and then slam a door. You know, that's what they used to do. Modern dentists are saving more lives than you can imagine. People used to die of their teeth all the time. Die. Because you'd get a tooth infection and you would die. It's not
fun. Yeah,
it's insane.
Insane.
Yes, that's not great.
So, yeah, that's where I am. On top of everything, my nanny kind of went MIA on me last week. So I'm juggling like chaos in my mouth and chaos in my household. So it's been an interesting couple of days, to say the least.
Now, when you say nanny, see, this is what amazes me about, you know, South Africa is more like the ancient Roman Empire than it is like any European modern country or America or China or anything like that. Because, you know, in South Africa, you don't have to be extravagantly wealthy to have someone to help look after the kids or to help clean the house or do any of that. You don't have to be like the, you know, the world's richest human being. Like if you had a nanny in England or in America, you'd have to be very, very rich. We're talking, we're talking like multi-millionaire in pounds or dollars to be able to do that, because the price of that kind of labor in those countries is very high. But here in South Africa, you can have like three or four people working for you in terms of domestic situations, looking after children, cooking, cleaning, ironing, doing the washing, doing the dishes, those kinds of jobs, because people, their own labor is valued at a certain level. And if you need someone else to do that stuff for you, you can find those people at a reasonably, I think, compared to what you'd pay anywhere else, a very reasonable fee. And those people also then earn enough to then be able to support their own families, which is an interesting place to be. You know, in ancient Rome, you know, you could have people working for you who didn't necessarily earn a lot of money, but you didn't have to either in order to employ them. And like if you were a farmer, you could have people working for you who were necessarily even poorer than you were. But like farmers weren't these super rich people who had these massive commercial farms. They, it was like subsistence stuff. And like if you don't have that nanny to help you, Libang, you've got too many things then in your day to be able to focus on the things that you need to do to make money. And it all starts, it starts snowballing.
No, 100%. And I think that's why when I consider the concept of nanny, I try to, you know, not, you know, pay the average rate. I do my best to pay more than I can, because I know that this person's job is to look after my children. If they're happy, then I know that they're going to, you know, pass on that energy to my kids.
And you don't
want to go through this thing where I'm paying them less.
And then you're a cheapskate, so you get a shittier person, and then they're resentful of you, so they don't do the right job with your children, and everybody loses, right?
But 100%.
But at the same time, if you overpay, sometimes you create a false economy, and then this person just leaves you like she did now, thinking she could do better.
I think that's exactly what I'm experiencing. And people are so desperate for work. Like there's people that are like, I'll even if you just give me R1,000 for a full month, I'll do it. And I'm like, are you insane? If I give you R1,000, you're gonna hate me.
Yeah.
You're absolutely gonna hate me. So I don't know, man. It's just one of those things. It's tough. It really made me think about like growing up as well. Like I've always seen my mom and dad switching nannies. And like every few years it was a different lady. And I don't think I got it when I was a kid. I was like, where's Sister Mang Mang going, you know?
Yeah.
Now I'm in the situation, I'm like, I get it. Some of these people just don't come back. They just find other work and they move on. But the worst thing is that they don't tell you.
No,
they can't just be like, look, here's the setup. You just see on WhatsApp statuses that people are turning up in Zimbabwe and you're like, how?
Yes.
Well, it's the sharp end of an informal market. So what you were talking about is, you know, in the United Kingdom, it's out of your hands. It is not possible. It's nearly impossible. I mean, listen, people do it all the time in the UK where you get Polish guys working illegally at people's houses. So please, let's not think they're perfect. But
and in America, in an informal market, it's a Mexican or a Puerto Rican woman, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever it may be, is in an informal market, there's a sharp end. There's a reason why we have these rules and we've had this march of progress. It protects both sides. So, again, you can't underpay, and now Lebanon can't complain in Switzerland, because there would be laws and that person would have some problems as well. So, hey, that is tough. So now, she just didn't come back one day, or what happened here?
So she said to me that she went for the jab and that her body's feeling weak, of which I got. I was like, okay, no, if that's the case, cool. Sure. You know, I can handle it on Monday. Sure. Tuesday, she still doesn't come back. I'm like, hey, girl, what's going on? She's like, no, you know, I've got low blood pressure, so I need a couple of days. So I'm like, a couple of days? How many is that? And then she sort of like blue tick me. So I'm like, let me call her husband, because there's always a man involved. It's another thing I just learned.
Yeah.
I call her husband. I'm like, hey, bro, what's going on? And he's like, no, we're actually on our way to Zim. She needs somebody to take care of her because she's very, very ill. I'm like, geez, I don't know if it was that bad. I'm so sorry. Let me know if you need anything, blah, blah, blah. At this point, I'm taking my kids to my mom's place just so I can get through the week. I kid you not, like 3 days later, just radio silence. We're off air. Like it's dead air. Nobody's saying anything. I'm like, what is actually going on? I just see WhatsApp statuses, her celebrating her birthday party. She's in this beautiful white dress. So I'm like, okay, firstly, that's Monson. This is definitely Joburg Town CBD. I know those buildings. Secondly, you look happy and healthy, girl. You look happy and healthy. I've just paid you your salary a couple of weeks ago. You are nice. So okay. I'm like, just tell me the truth. Are you ever coming back? But and then she just kind of broke down and just said she can't because where, her husband and.
No, but it's just, you know, this is the same weakness that you see in a lot of people who can't even explain to you why they couldn't pitch up for a social event. It happens. Like, people are just weak. Like, honestly, you know, if you can't make it to something, just say no.
Just say no.
This has always driven me crazy, whether it's a job, whether it's a dinner, whether it's some kind of massive event that's hugely important, or if it's just a family gathering. Just say, can't make it. Sorry.
I think people don't want to disappoint other people. But I mean, in this case, guys, this is her job. It's her 9 to 5. You should be able to explain.
But then, I mean, all the more reason. You know what's going to happen if you don't tell the truth in those situations? You disappoint people even more. And they lose respect
exactly.
for you. And they'll never hire like you again.
Yeah, no, I was quite shocked, but also not surprised because I also had another nanny a few months ago who had a similar situation where her husband got involved and it changed the scope of everything.
Oh, wow.
Suddenly, she's making more money than her husband and he didn't know how to feel about it because I pay relatively well. I'm like, I want these ladies to really feel like, you know, they can count on me because again, these are my kids that they're looking after.
Yeah, of course.
So the one lady last time just kind of went MIA and she eventually told me that her husband was complaining that she's earning way too much, or rather more than him. And it was, you know, causing some friction in their relationship. And then I thought about the dynamics that we maybe overlook sometimes. These are obviously low income earning people generally living in, you know, situations that they're not really in control of.
Yeah.
And some of them, most of them are foreigners and they're living with South African men. So there's already just these dynamics that they need to deal with. So imagine you're coming home every night, you're earning more than your man, and now you've got the power. What does your man have in that relationship? He's got the power. That's all that, most times, that's all that he's got. You can't strip him away of that. So it's crazy.
Okay, now this drives me, you talk about crazy, this makes me mad. This whole thing that somehow the man has to have some area where he's still the big cheese. This is such backward bullshit. I'm so over this. Does that man, I'd just like to get into some guy's head once who thinks that way and go, so you'd prefer to be even more poor, so she's not going to earn money at all. So you're both going to be poor, and whatever children you've got there are going
right?
to grow up in squalor. You'd rather have that because of your fragile little ego. Do me a favor.
It's so unfair.
Although it's across the board, we mustn't act like it's just low-income homes. Even yuppie people living in Hyde Park, I know people, guys, who get insecure about that. So that's just a human thing. I don't know whether it's genetic or not. I don't have all the available information, but it's real across the board.
Yes, but I'm not giving the poor a fucking break on this one. I'm sorry, because I'm sick of hearing in the news and everywhere else that you want to hear in the media, people give this kid glove treatment to poor people in this country. They're like, oh, but you know, it's because they've got a lack of resources. They had this thing on the news last night. This is on ENCA, I think. And they're showing this neighborhood in Cape Town called Kennedy Road. And if you saw the story, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's these blocks of flats that used to belong to the railway workers, okay? So they were built in the, I don't know, 50s, 60s, or 70s by the old regime. And then they were lived in by these people who worked for the railways. But they steadily declined and no one maintained them because it was the railway department's job to look after them, even though other people lived in them. And these places are now uninhabitable. There's sewage coming down the stairs. The place looks like Armageddon, right? And there's just trash everywhere. There are plastic bottles and cans and nappies and old shoes. And just, it's disgraceful. It's like the kind of mess that you wouldn't want your worst enemy to live in. And then these people are sitting there and they're like, well, someone's got to help us. And you're like, really? Because that mess that you're living in, you created. You did that. And I'm not giving you a free pass on this. Who's going to come and fix my house when there's a water leak? who's going to give me some resources? Because they're now asking for the resources from someone, right? Someone must come and bail them out. Someone must help them. And this guy's sitting there, and you could see he's like, he's just come off some tick trip, or he's just had a massive drunken weekend, because he's not entirely there. And someone is going to say, there's going to be some person who's going to go, oh, shame, poor them with this patronizing bullshit, and that their lives are never going to get better. You could throw all the resources at them. You're never going to fix the problem. And I look at this and I go, well, that over there is not politicians' fault. It's really not. You can blame the politicians for a lot. Okay, you can say the politicians are greedy and they steal and they don't put the right amount of money into infrastructure and they haven't helped people to improve their neighborhoods and maybe they haven't helped with transport so those people struggle to get jobs and whatever it might be. And all of that is true. But those people in those flats, it's their fault. They live like that and they've let themselves live like that. And a lot of that stuff doesn't require money. Picking up that shit outside your house is littered with shit. Literally, there's just a mess everywhere you look. That's because those people live. No, I'm not giving them a free pass. I'm sorry.
You know what? You know what the thing is, guys. I think like I agree with you 50%, but there's another part of me that's like, it's such a mental thing. Really, like inside of you, you have to believe in yourself and believe in the space that you live in so much that it's worth cleaning.
I know.
A lot of these people just don't.
Lebang,
they really do not.
I know, but then I can't help you. I don't have time in my day to sit down and mentally readjust you so that you can get your shit together because you're living like a wild animal. I can't help you. Like, no one can. There's no president who can help you. There's no municipal councillor that you're going to vote for in October or whatever that's going to come and help you. You are in that situation, and I'm sorry for you. I mean, it's obviously something I don't want you to live like that, but I also can't help you. It's just terrible. And you watch the news, and these people are like literally these reporters running around going, this is so horrible, and it's so unacceptable, and how can we allow this to happen? I'm like, I don't recall Lebang, Gareth, or Mbulelo going there and causing trouble for these people, making their lives worse on purpose, or leaving our rubbish there. I don't recall us doing that. We didn't interfere. This is a complete case of just destruction around these people, just complete and an attitude of like, well, someone else must rescue me, like infantilism. In their heads, they're always going to be children, and they're always going to need someone to bail them out. And I look at this and I go, as much as you want to attack, and I get it, like you want to attack some dude who lives in, as Mbulelo says, in Hyde Park, who also treats his wife like, you know, you shouldn't really earn more than me. And there are those douchebags in the world, and I get it. And they're a problem, but they're a much smaller problem than the problems that we're dealing with in that community I just described now that I saw in the news last night. And I look at it and I go, this is a false equivalence. We can't be drawing distinctions and similarities between those people, because there's something very, very ugly about the one situation. But in the other case, there's something so absolutely desperate and awful and sad and pathetic that the one situation is just not conducive to happy human beings living in any way in a meaningful and productive manner. The other one's just an asshole.
You know what's even more revolting? So I totally hear you on a sort of individualistic. That's hyper individualism there, but that's one thing. What's even more revolting, and it tells you it is a human thing, is when you do grow up in Bryanston and you're that person that you're saying you're not giving a break. That's even more revolting.
Right.
Where you live in a mansion and then you go and visit someone in their apartment. And they've been brought up swanky, and they live like monsters.
Yeah.
Like,
we've seen that.
What?
But,
yeah, it happens.
But you understand
that. So it's applicable across the human spectrum, is what you're saying.
Only in South Africa. Only in South Africa do we have this. No, it's maybe not only in South Africa. That's not the right way to start that sentence. There seems to be this desperate need to forgive all, like, poverty as being just a result of the natural world not coming together in your favor. Like, it's pure, like, oh, how unlucky. And to then patronize these people, and obviously there's a racial element in this country because that's our history, right? So when you see poor white people, you tend to, whether you like it or not, feel less sorry for them than you do for black people when they're poor, right?
That's true.
You know what I mean?
Straight up.
So when we see, like, a poor black person on the news, which is every goddamn night, because the news has got this almost like a fetishization of what it's...
Poverty porn.
That's exactly the point. It's like those people who come from Europe to go and tour, like, the worst parts of the worst townships, because then they go, oh, it's so awful, I saw the poverty with my own eyes. The people that you and I talk about that we can't stand in the mornings. But those people are also the ones who fuel this poverty porn in some way. And because we've got this complicated society in South Africa where we do have a lot of poor people and a lot of unemployed people who are in a position where they often can't help themselves, we tend to then think of them as virtuous poor, and we forgive them everything. Like nothing is their fault. Which is exactly the opposite of the way that those same people who say nothing's their fault treat someone who they don't like. Then it's all their fault. So they can switch on and off whether or not it's that person's fault in their own heads. I'm like, at least be consistent. If you're going to go after a capitalist profiteer, a crony, in cahoots with government, corrupt kind of person, right? Which you should do. We should all go after them. Then similarly, because you're giving that person the respect of agency, you're an individual human being who has the agency to make bad decisions or good, and we're judging you on your bad. We must do the same for the poor people. You can't say suddenly it's a different category and now we're not allowed to judge them as individuals, because then not only do you strip them of their agency, which I think is the most, then you're basically treating them like a second-class citizen. Even though you think you're doing them a favor, you're not giving them the respect of being an individual who deserves to be adjudicated on their individual decisions, traits, circumstances, responsibilities, etc. So do that. Just be consistent. That's all I'm asking of you.
But that's tied into two different things, right? Is number one, religion kind of leaves a gate for this, because blessed are the meek and they shall inherit the earth. And you see it in Africa a lot. So naturally, why would that not be the narrative of blessed are the meek? Oh, shame. So because it's built into the fabric of society. And I mean, listen, slavery and apartheid, of course, created this, created these divides. We have to be honest about that. But another interesting thing for me is just, if you go across the world, and it's so funny you're talking about this. I was talking to a friend of my mother's who's a relatively famous Kenyan historian, and we were discussing these sorts of things. And she was talking about, number one, the tribal thing. She says, if you go capitalist, and I kind of brought this up a while ago, but the tribal thing has to go, because we are recreating British society all over again. We're seeing it playing out with Jacob Zuma now, is that there are certain levels of people who cannot be questioned, rules, and you are condemned to being poor and to stay there.
And
that becomes what they call a self-fulfilled prophecy anyway. So there's an invisible ceiling, they call it in psychoanalysis. So naturally, and Lebang made the point just now, is inevitably if you feel like this is all it's ever going to be, you start to fill the rest of that picture out. So these people you're talking about, Gareth, as much as I'm an individualist, and sure that is the easy way once you've figured it out, but
don't
you fill the picture out of where you think your ceiling is in life. It's just the human way.
I got you. And my anger is not directed at the poor people that I'm talking about in the news. My ire is directed at those who turn them into stories and then create this category of being for them, which makes it seem that just by the very definition of your poverty, you are therefore in some way a better person who deserves a much more gentle approach by nature, life, and other people. Not so. So all I'm asking for is consistency. You know, when I meet someone, I don't know whether they have money or not. That's not the most important thing to me. I genuinely don't care. I've met amazing people who have bugger all money, and I've met terrible people who have lots and lots. So it's not an indicator of your worth as a human being. But it seems to me that the very people who keep telling us about equality the whole time are the ones who create these subcategories of people, where there are different rules. Now suddenly you can't judge someone. So if they're poor, it must be because it's everyone else's fault. It couldn't possibly be their own. And if we're going to advance anywhere in South Africa, if we're going to make this country better in any which way, personal responsibility is a major part of that. Just the way you raise your kids. I mean, if you are raising your kids the best way you can with as little as you have, and you're doing everything to make sure that you give your kids absolutely the bare necessities that they will need to get ahead as human beings, you have the world of respect from me. But if you are a father who doesn't even try to be involved in the raising of your children, and you've just made a woman pregnant and absconded, or you don't pay your maintenance, or you don't put any time or effort into your children, and then you complain about how the government also can't get you a job, and then some news reporter comes to your ramshackle, tumble-down house where you have spent the whole weekend just doing tick, and then they say, but this poor man, and it must be the politician's fault. I'm like, no, there's nothing Cyril has done to this guy for him to deserve this.
Yeah.
This is all him.
On that part, I definitely agree with you, Gareth. I've got a lot of family that live in townships, and about 3-4 years ago, my mom said to one of my cousins, you know what, come live with us, we'll sort everything out, that kind of vibe.
Right.
And we stayed with my cousin at home for about 3 years. Things were going okay, but generally, like, there was a huge disconnect mentally with how he viewed life and how the rest of us view life. And by the rest, I mean me and my siblings. Mm. He would, number one, he was generally much angrier off the bat because he was raised in a township. He experienced things completely differently to how we did. You know, he had to kind of grow up a lot quicker than we did and really fend for himself.
Sure.
And that is kind of why he ended up living with us. And just for him to get to where he is now he's left and he's gone back to the township, but he's a lot happier there, funny enough. Like, when he was with us, I noticed it's in the little things of not really taking personal responsibility for his own life. Mm. And that's why I'm saying it kind of goes back to the mental condition, of which you're absolutely right. We can't really help anybody who is in that place, but also we need to be aware of how they got to that place. You know what I mean? So he was never really willing to take responsibility. It was always somebody else's fault. Somebody always had to help him with even the smallest things. Only now, after, you know, having left, I could say, the suburbs and having gone back to the townships, he's now more aware of his own existence. He's taking more responsibility for himself, and he's owning that. Whereas when he first came to live with us, I was just like, yo, dude, are you okay? And he just generally wasn't. So there's a lot of healing and a lot of, you know, just situations that got him to that point, which is, you know, which is what a lot of people who grow up in townships generally experience. It's anger, it's hatred, it's negativity. And when you live in that environment where there's filth and dirt and whatnot, like, obviously the environment you live in has a huge impact on how you are and how you breathe and live and see life. So, so it's interesting. It's very, very interesting, but it's also very, very layered. I do agree that there's a lot of responsibility that needs to be taken for the individual. But at the same time, I'm very aware of the external factors that led to people not caring a damn and doing duck every day and not looking after their kids and, you know?
Well, I think, sorry, Gareth, just on Levan's point there, it's something I do have a massive, massive problem with as South Africans. You always say it brilliantly, is that we think there's a prize for humility, is that it could be the trajectory of our country. We're really, really young, but we don't have a systemic thought of excellence. So excellence to someone in Hyde Park, whereas if you go to Germany, the essence of brilliance from right from down in Stuttgart, I mean, you head right up to wherever you are in Bavaria, there's a notion of what being German is. There's a notion, there's a feeling of I'm German, that means something. And we haven't been able to really build that in South Africa for a multitude of reasons. And that matters because I believe in systemic thinking. I know you're more individualist, is that if the system cannot imbibe sort of low standards, it will reject it. So these things we'll see more and more of until South Africans learn
again
that the only way is to have standards.
We're not going to solve all of our problems in 3 generations. You know, this is going to take a long time.
No.
The world is still,
it'll take a while.
In every country in the world, they're dealing with inequality and with all kinds of difficulties and poverty. And I mean, there are people who live in those very conditions that I just described that I saw in the news last night, in virtually every country on earth. You'll find places like that everywhere, right?
Yep.
The problem I have is the attitude that we seem to take, the rest of us, I'm saying as observers. Like, I think we're doing these people even more of an injustice. You think you're being kind by not judging someone for living in their own ordure, okay? But actually what you're doing is you are, in your head, you're creating a subcategory just to make you feel better. That's what people do. And that drives me crazy because that is some deep-seated bullshit. And then you project that out into the world and you think it's okay to create these categories of people. Because in order for you to sleep at night because you've seen someone who's absolutely in squalor and you create a separate category and you just go, well, it's because they're poor. What you've really done is you've just made it sanitary enough for you to be able to live on the same planet without having to worry too much about them. Now, the alternative is, like, you can't worry about everybody. That's going to drive you crazy, right? So you have to find some way. But at least, if you're going to, from my point of view, the principle that will guide you in this and will make it possible for you to live without losing your mind in a world where there is such disparity and inequality and difficulty is to say, well, a large percentage of this is on the person, whether it's on Lebang or Gareth or Mbulelo. If you do really well in your life, I will give you all the credit for it, or at least the lion's share of the credit. And if you do really poorly in life, I will assign to you much of the blame. And it will be because of your choices, not because of your circumstances. Because you always, this Peter principle, which is what one of our listeners has just put up now. This is such an interesting point. The Peter principle is that no matter who you are, no matter where you're born, let me just find this thing because this makes a lot of sense.
Do you know the Peter principle? Okay.
I want to give credit to, here we are. Obi Kenobi says, there's a Peter principle, no matter what you're exposed to, good or bad, your real capabilities will hold you in a position you can sustain.
And it's called an endogenous theory. So it's a really, really interesting theory, that Peter principle. So it's endogenous. We went through it before. It means that so in science, when you talk of endogenous traits within a cell, what you're saying is that regardless of what the environment does, so it's what, like our circadian rhythm, if you're a human being, so it doesn't matter if it's hot, cold, you're in Sweden, your circadian rhythm is adapted to light, your sleep cycle is adapted to light. Endogenous means that the environment cannot affect that evolutionary trait. And the Peter principle speaks to
B says in a separate kind of analysis of the situation, enabling. If you help an alcoholic family member constantly and you feel sorry for them, it's only making you feel better, but it's actually not helping them, and they're gonna keep on drinking and drinking more.
Very true.
Since we were children, my father used to say to us, everything's your fault. And it's brutal when I say it to people.
That's right.
I agree with it. And you can't shock me with poverty. 99% of my family's poor. So everything's your fault. I do hate to admit that that's how I live my life across the board. You're not going to shock me with anything.
Well,
everything's your fault.
So even if it isn't, like, let's say terrible things happen to me or you or anyone else, and they're going to, like, terrible things are inevitable, just like good things you know, you can't make your life without ugliness, and you can't make your life without a couple of highlights somewhere along the way, but you're not in control of everything. So if those things happen but they're outside of your control, you can't take credit for them and you can't be blamed for them. But the reality is, like, you still can decide how you're going to react to them. And if you react to them badly, then you're just going to go down a very ugly tube that's not going to spit you out on the other side any better than you came in. And if you decide, I'm going to wrestle with this thing, I'm going to deal with it, and if it's my life's work to figure out why this one thing happened, then I'm going to do it. Because, you know, what else am I going to do with my 100 years if I'm lucky enough to live that?
I can identify with that. During the looting, obviously all the Zulu people tried to shut down the whole country. But
yes, right. You just blame all the Zulu people? Yes,
Sorry.
All right.
Did they not want to hear it?
No.
So I went to, they just the threat of looting shut down the Woolworths around the corner, and I didn't respond badly to that.
Poor you, Mbuela.
I had to go to a different Woolworths. Yeah, so I know what you're saying about when you face adversity and you turn it around by going to another Woolworths. It's a sign of who I am.
You are such a hero. You're such a hero.
Well, you said it. You said it.
And you managed to buy exactly those coffee beans that you like from Kenya because that's your thing.
No, I wouldn't be caught dead buying coffee beans at Woolworths. Let's not be ridiculous. That's terrible. Yeah.
Apologies.
No.
So we got some headlines. We'll get to those a little later on. But I mentioned that JJ Cornish is hanging on to tell us about Nigeria this morning. And that's exciting because we've wanted to get into the subject of Nigeria for the longest time. We've spoken about a couple of other African countries and focused on them as a part of African Analysis. It's, of course, brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. And this morning, JJ joins us live from his house. Hello, Mr. Cornish. How are you, sir?
I'm immensely well, but it's very kind of you to ask.
So, we're all very excited to hear about Nigeria today. And from the point of view of someone, again, JJ is a man who's traveled this continent far and wide. He's been an observer in elections. He's written endless articles, and he has probably the most put together idea of exactly what Africa and its politics and its history is all about in South Africa and from our point of view. So here he is this morning to share that wisdom with us. Tell us about Nigeria. This is our big competition in Africa, right? When we talk about Nigeria, we're talking about the other economy that we consider our equal.
Well, this is the point. The enmity or the competition between us, South Africans and Nigerians, supersedes any of the kind of colonial type competition we used to have with countries like Australia, New Zealand. Suddenly we are two major rivals for being the giant in Africa when we hear that Nigeria has become the largest economy in Africa. South Africans bridle at that. And they did this a couple of years back. They started to include their movies and music and various things to change their GDP, and suddenly they became the largest. But the fact is, Gareth, that Nigeria is a country that has surpassed India as having the highest number, 83 million people living in poverty, which is less than $2 a day. Oh. That number in India has gone down to 63 million. Nigeria is completely and utterly oil dependent. Oil has become, it's called the black curse in Nigeria because they make a lot of money from it, but they do not. That does not trickle down. Mm-hmm. We have that problem in South Africa too. Yeah. The wealth has not trickled down as our neighbors in Botswana and our regional partners, Zambia, love to tell us again and again. Nigeria does it in spades, so much that they have mend the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta that actually has taken militant action to get the people of certainly over the area where the oil is exploited to get them spread the wealth a little bit more. Now, when they act and they do kidnapping and so on, the oil production goes down. Nigeria produces currently 1.6 million barrels a day. In 4 years ago, it was 1.9 million. Now that makes them about the 17th largest oil producer in the world, and that's the second largest in Africa by quite a long chalk. But frequently, Angola, which produces 1.3 million a day, becomes the largest because the Nigerian taps just turn off. Wow. You still pay an inordinate amount of, and you can't always get petrol in Nigeria, even though we're an oil-producing country. So there's many, many, many contradictions. And, you know, that's not even going into the criminality in Nigeria. But I'd like to concentrate a little bit on this. I'm saying enmity. It's not enmity. It's the
rivalry,
the competition between us, and that is very, very strange. I mean, I had friends who used to academics and so on who've moved on to other jobs, but they used to feed me with academic studies from Nigeria showing that South Africa really isn't a proper African country. You know, so they had no compunction in putting us down at every single turn. And there are people around the world say, you know, you South Africans shouldn't be considered the gateway to Africa, as the cliche goes. You know, anybody visiting here, any Western leader visiting here always talks about the gateway to Africa. They say, for example, that BRICS, which was devised, the concept devised by an American academic, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, BRICS, should in fact not be, include South Africa, but should Nigeria. Nigeria should be the country representing Africa in that. And when we have the G20, when South Africa's included, no, it should be Nigeria. But when we look at what Nigeria can and cannot do, there's no doubt that we still should be. We still are the preeminent African power, and some would argue still the largest. So it's that kind of relationship that you have to look at, and I find that very interesting.
JJ, if you want to just on the numbers, because Nigeria is really quite extraordinary. It's not necessarily a very big country, but it has an enormous population, and it has such a diversity of language and culture from north to south and east to west. I mean, who are the main population groups there? What are the languages that are spoken? What are their major political challenges? Just from a, you know, from a demographic and geographic point of view, if you were busy reading this off to aliens who'd never been to planet Earth, what would you have to tell them about Nigeria?
Well, of course, the Nigerians have lurched from military rule to democracy ever since they got independence from Britain in 1960. Most of the time has been under military rule, but in 1999, I believe, the democracy came in, and that is when they celebrate Democracy Day.
That was Obasanjo,
it dates back
right?
to that.
That was Obasanjo, who was big friends with old Thabo Mbeki. The two of them really did try to bring us together as a continent.
And he had a bash it. He thought of hanging on, and it was Thabo Mbeki said, "Don't even think about it." And later, Obasanjo actually said to me, "It was the best advice I ever got from that man," because you know what a mistake it would have been. Any leader tries to cling to power. You know, I mean, I was president of our local Alliance Française, and I thought, how could I do it? You know, how could I hang on? I don't know why. It didn't pay me anything. But I think it's a natural human reaction if you've got some influence to want to hang on, and that's it. Now, of course, Nigeria then have, I mean, the major groups are Hausa in the north, Yoruba in the west, and Igbo in the east. And those are the major groups. And it was early on, relatively early on in independence, that the Biafran secession took place, and there began the Nigerian Civil War from 87 to 90, where we had those awful pictures. I can remember them of the Biafrans were starved to death more than actually fought to death. And that still exists to this day. You have the indigenous people of Biafra, a group which has its leadership abroad, I have to tell you. For their own safety, they have to be there. And that secessionism still exists. Of course, we have the divide, the religious divide. It's almost half and half, Christian, half Muslim. And up in the northeast, the Muslims and spearheaded by this group called Boko Haram, which means that teaching is wrong, and they've become a secessionist group, remember the kidnapping of the 200 schoolgirls. Kidnapping, of course, is a major crime source in Nigeria. Corruption being the worst, violent crimes, robberies, and so on, the worst, the second, and that includes kidnapping for money, thefts, and drugs. Those are the sort of major crimes. and they export them. The Nigerians do. It's very uncool to talk about it here. And yeah. I know colleagues of yours, former colleagues of yours and mine, having got into trouble making sort of jokes about Nigerians yeah. And criminality, you know, categorizing them, which is, of course, completely incorrect. But nevertheless, these exist. And we have Muhammadu Buhari, the current president, who was, and it has to Nigeria's credit, he was an opposition figure who came to power.
Right.
That's the real test of African democracy for me.
Yeah.
It's all very well to have a new leader come in, but if they actually get a change of parties, that's real democracy, as has occurred in Ghana as well. You know, those countries, that's real democracy. But it has to be said that Muhammadu Buhari was himself a military leader. He had beaten somebody in a coup, and he is now a Democrat, so to his credit. But he's been unable to get a hold on the secessionists. And he keeps saying he will and he can, but he hasn't been able to. And so Muslim jihadism is joined by Niger, countries on that northeastern border, Chad and Niger, and making it very, very, very difficult. So we have this country that is supposed to be the largest economy, but when you speak to potential investors, and I don't want to say too much about this because we have potential investors that are driven away from our country. I know that.
Yeah.
But potential investors say it's too dangerous to be there. And many countries still, countries that have more of a sort of a nanny approach to looking after their citizens, the United States and Britain, Australia, all of those, actually advise people not to go to Nigeria.
So there's
a dichotomy.
You've been there, though. What is it actually like to be in Nigeria? Because I've heard from friends of mine who've done business there and people who've been out there doing, I don't know, all kinds of media stuff. They say that it's a fascinating place. I mean, it seems that almost there are no rules on the ground. But you do need personal protection. If you even are supposedly a little bit more important, if you stick your head slightly above the parapet wall, it attracts very dangerous attention sometimes. And people need to have certain streams of being able to enter and exit the country. There need to be certain people there to help them look out for trouble. You have to stay in certain places and not in others. Is that an overreaction? Is that too much of that nanny stuff that you're talking about, or is that the reality?
The reality is that it's a pretty hard society. You know, when you hand your passport in to be stamped, you have two or three crisp $10 bills inside that passport.
Gotcha.
And that's, you know, when you talk about corruption being endemic, well, it certainly is the case there.
Yeah.
And as for protection, well, happily I dress like a journalist, which is very badly, and I've never felt that kind of fear. But if you do have, they do say that Lungus, you know, white people have less problem in terms of security. But, you know, in Nigeria, you can put up burglar bars and trelly doors, and I'm using a brand name, but whatever.
Sure, we got you.
And that doesn't matter to Nigerians. They'll just bring a pickup truck and a winch and rip that stuff out if they want to get into your house. When they talk about home invasions in Nigeria, they're not kidding. They literally invade your home and you know, take out you and everybody else in it.
But the crime
is much more violent there.
There are obviously places in Nigeria where it's amazing because, just like any other country on earth, even places like, God forbid, Equatorial Guinea, which we've spoken about before, there are some very rich people. Usually they're the ones who are politically connected. Usually they're the ones who have a lot of guns. And they live in splendor. And then there are people just down the road who are living in the kind of squalor I was talking about earlier on the show. So there must be some things about Nigeria that make it exciting and dynamic and fun and full of. I mean, we know about Nollywood, for example. You mentioned it earlier in your introduction. There's a thriving economy on the streets.
Well, you know, you get the sense, Mbulela was talking about it earlier, being in Germany.
Hmm.
You get it also in the United States. We are in the United States. We are at the center of the Western world. We run this joint. When you're in Germany, they're a little cooler about it. But the fact is, when you're in Germany, you realize you are in the beating heart of Europe. And that they run the joint. Now, when you're in Nigeria, Nigerians try to tell you this, you know, that we are running this joint. We are running Africa. But when you look around and see, you realize they're not actually, you know. By the same token, if somebody said to you in South Africa, we're running the joint, it would be a little bit more credible. But you'd see the holes in it all the time. So it is a truly fascinating country. I have to say, visiting it is not, you know, not top of my bucket list, because I don't like the idea of having to buy my way around. Yeah. And that's literally what you have to do. And to see a country with that much potential underachieving to the extent it does. Again, it gets to the subject you were talking about before. You see it in India where you see, you know, again, that there's nothing more irritating than have somebody saying, I was there, and particularly a South African, I was there, I saw the poverty myself. You want to shake them and say, have you actually seen the poverty at home?
Yeah.
You know, right. Have you bothered to look at that? Well,
what's it like?
But the thing is,
what's it like driving in Nigeria? I've heard that's quite that's quite an exciting thing to take part in, especially Abuja.
I have driven in India, and I have driven, I mean, in Italy, which I thought was scary. When I was driving in India, yeah. I was there with Kwame Nkrumah's son. You know, he's an Egyptian journalist. And I said, I don't understand. You get to a traffic circle, and then by osmosis, half an hour later, you'd be across it. How do people do this? He'd say, wait until you get to Egypt. Then you'll really understand bad driving. Okay. Well, all they do is they take a four-lane highway and they make it eight.
Yeah,
they just drive where they shouldn't be, and driving in Egypt is a little bit scary. But the worst driving, and Nigeria is better than that, slower but better. The worst driving I've ever seen is in Tehran. That is really scary.
Really,
with people on the outside lane wanting to turn off, wait until the last moment, and then cut across four lanes right in front of you. And so scary driving. That's another topic for another day. But the driving in Nigeria is probably as bad as it is in Kenya.
So,
you know, the road system isn't great. It just takes forever, and that's why they have boda bodas, you know, which are the motorbikes. And I, you know why they called boda boda, by the way?
No.
Because they were the little bikes that took you from the border, from where you cross the border into town. So boda boda, from
that's
taking
amazing.
You, or you sit on the back of it and get taken into town. And so the ingenuity of the Nigerian people is something. And in that regard, what they've done for their system is make it work, you know.
Angus Clark says, ask JJ about the area boys. It's like a protection racket. Do you know anything about that?
I've not heard of the area boys. No, I haven't. Okay. I mean, protection rackets exist all the time. But, I mean, you know, I've experienced those in the United States. So, I mean, protection is something else.
I'm sure.
But, no, I haven't heard of the area boys.
And JJ, you know, for most people that sort of romanticize Nigeria and getting into the, you know, it's just that time is... I think, I don't know if you've had time to go to VI at all, Victoria Island, and just maybe you could explain the difference between when you get there going to Victoria Island and maybe as you leave, like five or six minutes outside of that whole setup.
Yeah.
Well, you know, traveling around, I've been very, very limited. I've been in with the president, and I'd like to have traveled more and seen more. But again, I would like to do it on my terms and understanding my safety. And that's not the case. The thing about it is, you know, this dream we have, or not the dream, but it's the kind of the magic words of the Africa, the continent whose time has arrived. Because of Nigeria, because of South Africa, that because of the pandemic has changed completely. And those middle income, and that's what we would like to call ourselves, countries, are in great, great trouble economically, that we can export our way out of the trouble we're in. Again, Nigeria's problem. That's going to be much, much, much more difficult. So if we're going to make things work, as we have to, as we simply have to, then are we going to have to work together with Nigeria and not against them? And that is what we are doing. I'm surprised, Gareth, that you haven't asked me about my headgear.
Yes, I did see someone made a comment just now about your excellent headgear. In fact, they I think they named it correctly as well, too. Someone says here, what a great hat you're wearing. What is that hat? Where is it from?
It's from Afghanistan.
Oh, it's one
of
those.
Yeah, look at this.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I got one of those too.
I put it on. You know, if you had
a Chitrali, is that a
so
Chitrali
serious
hat?
To that? You know what it's called? I'll tell you once, and you will never forget it.
Yeah,
it's called a pokol.
A pokol.
Now, if you're Afrikaans speaking, you would take exception to what I've just said, but. But it's called a pokol, I brought it. It brought with it a lot of Afghani bugs,
oh, no.
Which ate into parts of it. So I exported the Afghani bug industry.
Oh,
but
God.
It's an apposite day to be wearing it,
no,
because Afghanistan will not be in the news next time you and I speak.
No, I mean, isn't that funny? Because it was all over the news the last time we spoke. JJ, thank you. I mean, we could probably talk about Nigeria for a whole show and we wouldn't run out of things to say. But I appreciate you giving us a condensed version and in your own experiences too. I think it's probably one of those places that are fascinating, but you wouldn't plan a holiday there necessarily. If you end up going to Nigeria, you go to Nigeria, and it's probably interesting. But it's not the sort of place you go, all right, family, let's all hop on a plane and go to Nigeria. I've heard that's a really great place to go for holiday, right?
Certainly not. You go there because you're going to make money.
Yeah.
Same reason for Angola. I think many reasons, the same reason. I must tell you one final story. I'm landing.
Yes.
Plane's coming down. Next to me is a guy looking absolutely terrified. Quite a big dude as well.
Yeah.
I said, you don't look comfortable. He said, I'm not. I've got to overnight in Johannesburg. So I said, not a problem. I can understand your trepidation if you've been reading the news. Yeah. Where would you go? And he mentioned, what's that big tall block of flats near in Hillbrow?
And he said
that they told me to go there. I said, don't even think about it. You look quite well healed to me. Why don't you go to the Sandton Sun, spend the loot, stay the night there? Take a walk around Sentence and go to a restaurant there. Check with the concierge before going anywhere. Tell him I'm going to such and such a place. Many countries I've been in, including Brazil, you have to do that because you want to take a chance. So he said, well, thank you very much. I feel a little bit more relieved. I will do that. I'm there on business. I've got to spend the night and I'm terrified. So I said, you'll be okay if you listen to my advice. Go to Sentence, stay at the Sentence Sun and check where you're going. Don't go adventuring or looking for stuff. Okay.
No, don't go to Boxburg or anything like that. Yeah.
Where are you from? He said, Nigeria.
See, that's it. Love it. All right. Very good. Thank you, JJ. Great to see you. JJ Cornish.
All the best.
Very good.
And thanks, JJ.
African analysis brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School. Mm-hmm. That's, you see, like that's how they see us. That's how we see them. So much of it is just nonsense. Absolutely crazy. All right, when we come back, because it's 7 o'clock, we've got lots of other stuff to get to. We haven't even done some headlines today. So we'll go to that in a second. We're also going to talk to the human lie detector. That's right, somebody who can help you figure out if someone is lying to you or not. Ooh, isn't that that's a superpower you want to have. That and a whole lot more on the way.
CliffCentral.com.